Shrink Wrap Radio number 6, September 5th, 2005. Interview with Larry Robinson, psychotherapist, ecologist, poet, and politician. Hi everyone, this is David Van Nuys, aka Dr. Dave. Thanks for tuning in to Shrink Wrap Radio, originating from the beautiful wine country of Sonoma County, California. This is the podcast that brings you all the psychology you need to know, and just enough to be a little bit dangerous. We feature interviews with fascinating people in and around the world of psychology. Today's guest is Larry Robinson. Speaking of fascinating, Larry is one of the most interesting and accomplished people I know. We've been in a small men's group together for over 15 years. Larry is one of those people who seems to know quite a bit about nearly everything. And having been in this group together, I've watched him grow tremendously over the years. I watched him move out of despair over environmental degradation into becoming a political activist. Without further ado, let's get into the interview. Okay, Larry, I know that you have been, over the course of your life, a man of many different careers. When was it that you first knew that you wanted to be a therapist?
I think I figured that out when I was an undergraduate, even though I was studying linguistics primarily, linguistics and psychology. Most of my psychology coursework was had to do with Freud and Jung, mm-hmm. And I was fascinated with that, and I think practiced unlicensed amateur psychology on my friends. But at the time, the only avenue to practicing psychology that I knew of was to go to medical school, do a psychiatric residency, and then psychoanalytic.
A daunting path.
Too daunting for me.
Right.
So I took another route, and finally, many years later, realized that I could do it through the marriage and family therapist license.
Right, which probably didn't really exist in that form when you were an undergraduate.
That's true.
And that option, that master's level option, only emerged many years later.
Yeah.
But on the way to that, let's see, a couple things I'm aware of is you were a headhunter for a while, and you had a video store.
And a plant store, and for 4 years I was executive director of a nonprofit community agency, Petaluma People Services Center. And before that, I had started and run a private alternative school and done that for 4 years and then taught in the public schools for a couple years.
Oh, my goodness. So if this isn't too personal a question, how old were you when you finally did become a psychotherapist?
Well, let's see. I was 30 years old when I went back to school to get my master's in counseling. But then it was probably another 10 years before I got my license and started my private practice, because I got detoured into other pursuits.
Yeah. And what at the core would you say, what was the core of your desire to be a therapist?
Well, I think my original training as a psychotherapist was in my family. That was my role as a child.
Uh-huh. As it was for so many of us.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And you know, I sometimes wonder whether it was how much of it was my conditioning as a child that led me into the field, and how much was what James Hillman suggests in his acorn theory, that there's something in my soul that was destined to do this and sought out circumstances and conditions that would shape that.
Right, right.
Now, interestingly, you are a therapist who's gone into politics, which I think is fairly unusual. Having now been twice the mayor of Sebastopol, California, what caused you to move into local politics?
Love of this place.
Love of Sebastopol?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And wanting to protect it from the kind of destruction that I witnessed happening to so many other communities. But it was also, I think, an outgrowth of my passion for eco-psychology, which is an attempt to reimagine a psychology that's rooted in the basic understandings of deep ecology. And that led me to, as you know, under your aegis when you were chairman of the psych department, teaching those two courses at Sonoma State in eco-psychology and psychotherapy. And part of what I was teaching to my students was more preaching, in a way, was that as therapists, psychologists, we need to be much more involved in the greater healing than just focusing on those privileged few that can afford to pay private practitioner fees.
Right.
And at a certain point, I realized that I was not listening to my own advice, and that if I really was going to be consistent and true to my own ideals, I needed to take more responsibility for my community than just working, as I said, with those privileged few.
Right, right. And you use a term that not everyone may be familiar with, deep ecology. I wonder if you could sort of briefly summarize what that term means.
Well, deep ecology is a perspective on ecology or living systems that is not anthropocentric, that doesn't see humanity, people, as the center of our ecosystem, but as one particular expression of the web of life, but not the focal point of it.
Okay. And I'm wondering how your background in psychotherapy has affected the way that you see the political process and how it has affected the way you behave as a politician. How do these two histories merge and cross-pollinate one another?
Well, that's a fascinating question. I think a lot of the skills that I developed as a therapist are transferable. One certainly is the practice of paying attention and listening.
Right.
And I know most politicians are much better at talking than they are at listening.
I've noticed that on television.
Yeah, we see a lot of that lately.
Yeah.
But what I found in campaigning is that that people really need to know that there's someone paying attention to them. And even if we have partisan differences, they're willing to vote for me because they know that I can understand what they're saying, that I take them seriously, that I'm paying attention, that I'm listening to them. And yeah,
this community, I guess, is small enough that you've actually done a lot of door-to-door campaigning and had a lot of direct contact. How many souls live in Sebastopol?
About 8,000.
Okay.
And it's small enough. It's 2 square miles in area. And it's small enough that in a 4 or 5 month campaign season, you can knock on every door.
Wow.
It's
even
a lot
so,
of work. But
even
you,
so, yeah, that sounds like a lot of work. Are there any other thoughts that come to mind about this, the way that this background as a psychotherapist has informed the way you operate or see the political world? You mentioned listening.
Yeah, well, the issue of of transference and projection come up frequently.
I'll bet.
In my therapy practice, working with transference was a key piece of the process.
And just for our listeners, by that I take it you mean irrational ways that people see you because of their own deep issues, and so they're likely to have either unrealistically positive or unrealistically negative
exactly
responses to
exactly
you. And you see that happening in the political arena as well?
Yes, it's in a much more exaggerated way than it happens in a therapist-client relationship.
I was just going to say I could see that there'd be a strong pull for whoever's in that position of leader, whether it's mayor, governor, president, extremes of good father, bad father.
Yeah, that's exactly the issue that I have to work with constantly. When people project the good father onto me, the hero, you know, the savior for them, there's a great temptation to take that on and be inflated by it and think, oh yeah, I'm doing a great job. And then the next person comes up and condemns me for whatever the other projection is. If I believe the positive projection, then I'm also inclined to believe the negative, and it puts me on an emotional roller coaster. So
right.
My experience as a therapist in learning to identify the projection, the transference, and my own countertransference, my own reaction to that, helps me keep a more even pace and not identify with people's pictures mm-hmm. of me.
Mm-hmm. And to bring in another thread here, as if it wasn't complex enough already, I believe you're a Buddhist, so I would think that maybe that practice would also play a role in finding this centered place.
Absolutely. That's that's probably my 35 years experience of meditation has, I think, given me the tools that I need to survive in politics and actually use the political experience as part of my spiritual mm-hmm. practice. Mm-hmm. The art of paying attention, showing up emotionally, opening the heart of compassion, speaking the truth, and letting go of the outcome. Those are the four key practices that for me integrate the spiritual and the political.
I wish more of our politicians were trying to hold those four principles. You're also a member of the Green Party, and can you say a bit about that? What that party is about, how you came to be affiliated with it?
Well, the Green Party is a response to what many of us see as the failure of the two-party system. I mean, the two-party system in America has really become two wings of one party. And granted, there's huge differences between those two wings, but they are both primarily representing the corporate interests over the interests of people, over the interests of the natural world. Mm-hmm. So the Green Party is committed to the principle of sustainability, which addresses everything from ecological responsibility and sustainability to social sustainability, social responsibility, and economic. I mean, in Sebastopol, we're trying to balance all of those, and we're one of the few cities in this area that actually has a balanced budget. We're living within our means, and We're also addressing issues, social issues like affordable housing, as well as protecting our water sources and the wetlands and the critical habitat.
Right, and I know you're very actively protecting those sorts of interests and issues. For example, I know that you've called a community meeting about the issue of peak oil, and that you're also in the wake of the hurricane Katrina, that there's going to be a community meeting, I guess, about disaster preparedness, because earthquakes are a huge consideration here.
One of the things that I'm initiating is a series of town hall meetings based on the town hall meetings that have been held in small New England towns for centuries that predate the establishment of the United States. And one of the impetuses for the meetings is to bring the different factions of the community together in one room where we can hear each other rather than...
And there are factions here, right?
There certainly are factions.
Like everybody is Green Party.
Right. I mean, the Green Party members are a majority of the city council, but they there are only 300 registered Greens in the city versus, I believe, 1,800 Democrats and 500 Republicans. But
and then there must be a lot of independents, since that doesn't add up to 8,000.
Well, yeah, but not 8,000 are registered voters.
I mean, there's
a lot of children.
Right,
you know.
Right. Are there other Green Party mayors in the country? Do you know?
My good friend Larry Barnett is mayor of Sonoma, the other side of this county.
Okay.
He's a Green. Lou Tremaine is a Green, is the mayor of Fairfax in our neighboring Marin County.
What about outside of California?
New Paltz, New York. Jason West is the mayor there. I'm not sure of other cities outside California. My good friend Mike Feinstein had been mayor of Santa Monica. He's another Green.
Okay. Well, it's interesting. I know that as a result of your political involvements, you've had at least two international invitations that I'm aware of. Maybe you could talk a little bit about those two events.
Well, one was the World Mayors for Peace Conference in Hiroshima, Japan, in the year 2001.
I didn't even know about that one. That wasn't even one of the ones I was referring to, but go ahead.
That was a gathering of, I believe, there were about 300 of us, mayors and other elected representatives from 120 cities around the world, from China, India, Japan, Russia, France, Canada, Mexico, U.S., Iran. Mm-hmm. I met mayors of several Iranian cities and had some wonderful connections with them. And this gathering was to address our shared concern about nuclear proliferation, given that most of our national governments are not doing enough, I believe, to address one of the biggest threats to global security, which is nuclear proliferation. We figured that mayors can have some impact, and I think we are,
right,
working as a united voice. So that was one conference. In 2002, I was invited to give an address at the Praxis Peace Conference in Dubrovnik, Croatia. This is in the Alchemy of Peace Building.
Okay, yeah, that's one of the ones I was thinking of. Yeah.
And my speech there was on politics as a spiritual practice. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, I thought that sounded like a really exciting opportunity there, that the one in Croatia.
It was.
Yeah. And then there was, more recently, you got invited to go to China.
I spent 2 weeks in China in this past June and July, meeting with various mayors and council members and Communist Party officials and business leaders in Beijing and Shenyang and Dalian, Haimen, Shanghai, Guangzhou, one other city, I can't remember.
Okay. Did you form any impressions about either about China or what it's like to be a mayor in China versus a mayor in Sebastopol, California?
Well, it was pretty clear that in China, the local party chairman far outranks the mayor.
Uh-huh.
But as a mayor, I was treated with a great deal more respect over there than I am here. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't expect to be treated like anybody special here.
Yeah.
I expect when I walk down the street to be accosted and asked what's happening about traffic or this sidewalk issue or somebody's complaint or something like
that. How come you haven't fixed the potholes?
Exactly, right. Exactly. But visiting in China, I was treated like a very important person. And it's a rare experience.
Yes. Don't forget your Buddhist practice now. I'm not getting inflated.
Not get attached.
Don't get attached. Don't get inflated. As many people look at the country and even the world, many people, and especially young people, are turned off by politics, kind of losing heart. And what would be your message for them?
I can certainly understand why they would be discouraged, why they would become cynical. And I think that there are forces in our culture that profit from people's disengagement and cynicism, and that would just assume more people not get involved in politics.
So where does the hope lie?
The hope lies in people and in young people, but really in all of us. In ancient Greece, they talked about two kinds of people. The civic-minded people, politicians in other words, those who were engaged in the life of the polis, the life of the community, and idiots. In ancient Greece, the idiot literally was the private person. Now, it didn't refer to someone's IQ. It just referred to someone who was not engaged in the life of the community.
Interesting. I've never heard that.
And I think we have far too many idiots, and we're conditioned to think of ourselves as consumers rather than citizens, mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
The archetype of the citizen has gone into decline, and the archetype of consumer is what's the one that is really informing most of our lives in this country. And I think that we need to reinvest in the archetype of the citizen.
Mm-hmm. And I guess one of the key differences between those two archetypes is that the archetype of the citizen would be active. It's about active participation. The archetype of the consumer is about passive
consumption. Just mm-hmm. The image that comes to mind is the goose who's force-fed food down a tube to swell the liver that becomes the pâté de foie, the gourmets seek out. And in a way, our livers are being swollen by what, well, and again, in Greece, this disease that Socrates referred to as pleonexia, the disease of having too much. Mm. You know, we have too much materially, and that leaves us spiritually impoverished.
Mm-hmm. I know that you've talked to young people, that you've gone to some, recently you were at a retreat of some sort where there were a lot of underprivileged young people. What kind of message do you give them, you know, when they're coming from a place of despair and discouragement?
Well, here's a poem that that may address this. Ecclesiastes says, "For everything there is a season." You say, "It's tax season. It's allergy season. It's baseball season. I've got to season the steak on the Barbie. Besides, I don't have time to change the world." Goethe tells us of the genius, the power, and the magic in boldness. And you say, "What difference could I make anyway? The foxes are guarding the henhouse. The juggernaut's out of control. We're all just snowflakes in the wind." The mountain asks, "Which snowflake falling will be the one to send down the avalanche, changing this entire landscape?"
Beautiful, beautiful. And who's that by?
That's mine.
That's yours? You wrote that?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. You sort of jumped my, stole my thunder here, because I was going to say, and Larry Robinson is also a poet, and has been known to actually recite poetry at city council meetings. Now, I suspect that while there may be other Green Party mayors around, I doubt there's anybody else that recites poetry at city council meetings. Or am I wrong? Do you know someone else?
I don't know of any yet, but I'm hoping it becomes a trend.
Okay.
Because we need more poetry in our lives.
Right. Is there another poem that you'd like to take us out with? Put you on the spot. There may or may not be.
Yeah, this is one by Gary Snyder.
Right.
Called "For the Children." He says, "The rising hills, the slopes of statistics lie before us. The steep climb of everything going up, up as we all go down. And the next century, or the one beyond that, they say, are valleys, pastures. We can meet there in peace, if we make it. To climb these coming crests, one word to you and your children. Stay together, learn the flowers. Go light."
Mayor and poet Larry Robinson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Dave.
Well, that's it. I sure hope you enjoyed this podcast. I know that I did. Today was a red letter day for Shrink Wrap Radio, because we finally got our artwork up and appearing in the iTunes music store. So be sure to check that out. Please email your comments to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com and tell all your friends to visit us. We'd love to get audio comments as well, which you could send to that same email address. I've got lots of great guests lined up for the future, and you can leave audio comments on Gizmo Project for the name Shrink Pod. Finally, if there are any podcasters listening, let's talk about swapping promos. Speaking of promos, Rob Walsh of Podcast 411 has been a tremendous help to me and to other podcasters as we've been trying to figure out this new technology. So let's listen to one of his promos.
Hello, I'm Wichita Rutherford from 5 Minutes with Wichita, and I'm here to tell you about the Podcast 411 podcast. Now, Rob, he interviews other podcasters to find out what they've learned about doing a podcast, and it's been described as Inside the Actor Studio, except it's for podcasts. His past guests include Adam Curry, he's the Podfather, Senator John Edwards, C.C. Chapman, PK&J, Bib and Yaz, Chris Rockwell, and yours truly, Wichita Rutherford. That's just naming a few of them. Now, if you want to learn more about podcasting or podcasters, then you go over and visit them at podcast411.com. And remember, listen different with Podcast 411. It's just so precious.
So until next time, this is Dr. Dave reminding you, it's all in your mind.